This edition of the week is sponsored by Invitrogen. Gibco Cell Culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.
This week, we're focusing on some of the unsolved mysteries of the brain. We'll be finding out how powerful the brain's reward pathway is.
We will stimulate certain parts of the brain electrically, and the animals really like this. And if we give them the opportunity to do this, they'll do it for hours on end and even days on end.
We'll also be finding out what an hallucinogenic drug, used originally by Mexican shamans, can reveal about our moods. Hi, I'm Carrie Grenz, and welcome to this edition of the podcast. First up, in the June issue of The Scientist, I wrote an article about the neurobiology of addiction. Bill Carlezon at Harvard Medical School's McLean Hospital studies the pathway involved in addiction and the ways that other psychological disorders, like depression, share or even reinforce this pathway. Essentially, the pathway comes down to dopamine release in an area of the brain called the nucleus accumbens. Drugs like cocaine and heroin will alter gene expression in the nucleus accumbens through a transcription factor called Kreb. Carlezon and I recently spoke about Kreb's link to depression.
One of the things that happens with Kreb is that it's activated by drugs of abuse and stress. And these are two things that we know in humans lead to, number one, more drug abuse, and number two, depressive-like states, particularly during drug withdrawal. So what we've done is study how Kreb in a very specific part of the brain called the nucleus accumbens is activated by drugs and stress. And when we mimic this effect through some engineered genomic technologies that we've developed, we get an animal that often acts depressed and kind of pre-stressed out. And this has enabled us to kind of develop relationships between Kreb and the nucleus accumbens, the brain region we study, and depressive-like behaviors. If we were to extend out our findings, we might predict that people who were depressed have more Kreb in the nucleus accumbens. And that may contribute to their depressive behavior. But that has not been established, in fact, and it's not the type of research we do. What we would try to do in our group is to try to focus on the environmental stimuli and to try to mimic the environmental stimuli by going into the nucleus accumbens itself and turning Kreb on or turning Kreb off and seeing what this does to the behavior of the animal.
So if you turn Kreb on for some period of time, then what happens to an animal's behavior?
You know, obviously it's difficult to project out from an animal how the animal is feeling, what kind of mood state the animal is in, but we actually can do that to a certain extent by taking advantage of some of the things that the animals can tell us. So one of the things we know about rats and mice, over the years we've developed methods of figuring out what these animals like and the types of things that are rewarding to them. So they like palatable foods like sugar. They like drugs of abuse like cocaine or heroin. They like interacting sexually with female animals, if we're talking about male animals. And they really like this thing called brain stimulation reward, which we can do in the lab. There really is no analogous situation in humans, but basically what we do is we will stimulate certain parts of the brain electrically, and the animals really like this. And if we give them the opportunity to do this, they'll do it for hours on end and even days on end. So it's very reinforcing to them. So an example of what we might do is to take one of these behaviors where we know whether something is rewarding or not, go into the brain and manipulate Kreb function, and then we see how that's affected the rewarding properties of the stimulus. So if we go into the nucleus accumbens and stimulate Kreb, what we find is that drugs are less rewarding, sexual behavior is less rewarding, palatable food is less rewarding, and this brain stimulation reward is less rewarding. And the way we interpret these data is that the animals are now in a state of anhedonia. Anhedonia is defined as a reduced ability to experience pleasurable things as being pleasurable, and this is something that we see all the time in our human patients who are suffering from depressive illness.
And then what happens then if you manipulate Kreb such that you reduce its expression in the brain or reduce its activity?
In general, we get the opposite effects. One of the things that we find is that the animals that we go into the nucleus accumbens and turn off CREB expression, these animals actually look like they've been treated with antidepressants. And if we line them up, if we line up two animals in a behavioral test, one of which had been treated with antidepressants and one of which had just had CREB turned off in the nucleus accumbens, they really are indistinguishable. Their behaviors are indistinguishable. So we've been really encouraged by this because we think that it gives us potentially new targets for antidepressant drugs.
And some of those I mentioned in my feature, but we can go over them as well. What are some of the ones that you think are particularly intriguing in terms of CREB targets?
The one that we focus, there's so many CREB targets, and the CREB targets seem to differ from brain region to brain region, so we really can't we can't go too far afield. So what we've been doing really is focusing on one CREB target, and that CREB target is dynorphin, which is an endogenous opioid. It's an opiate-like compound that's made by your brain.
And so what does CREB do to dynorphin?
CREB will activate dynorphin. And it will increase dynorphin function in this brain region. And it turns out by virtue of where the receptors for dynorphin are in the nucleus accumbens, dynorphin stimulating the receptor, which is called a kappa receptor. We always wish it would be called a dynorphin receptor, but science often is pretty complex, and the particular receptor that dynorphin binds to is called kappa receptor. So when the dynorphin binds to kappa receptor and stimulates it, it ends up turning off the main brain reward system, which is called the mesolimbic dopamine reward system. And we think that this is what's causing a lot of the symptoms of depression that we can see in our animals.
So you might be able to exploit this?
Exactly. That's what we're thinking. The way we would exploit it is to try to turn off dynorphin function. And one way we can do that is to block the receptor for dynorphin. And this would be a class of chemicals called kappa antagonists or kappa receptor blockers. When we give these to the animals, they act like they're on standard antidepressant drugs. So we've been really encouraged by this.
So there's another transcription factor that I really don't give enough thought to in my piece, and I wish I had more space. I could do an entire feature on this one. It's called delta-phosb, and it also plays a role in dynorphin regulation. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that fits into our understanding of addiction?
Sure. Delta-phosb is a really unique molecule. It's also a transcription factor, just like CREB. And one of the things that's very unique about delta-phosb is it takes a long time to break down, whereas if you were to stimulate CREB, if you were to do something to an animal that would stimulate the transcription factor CREB, that would only last for a little while. You'd only be able to detect increases in CREB function for an hour, maybe, or even less. The thing about delta-phosb is that it takes a long time to break down, and it accumulates in the brain with repeated stress or repeated drug addiction. So the idea is that every time we give an animal an injection of an addictive drug, or a person takes an addictive drug, what's happening is that the delta-phosb is building up in the brain. And this is exactly the type of molecule you would expect to play an important role in addiction, maybe less so in depression, but in addiction, because addiction is such a long-lasting illness or disorder, and what happens is that people might come to a place like where I work, McLean Hospital, and stay here for 30 days in a drug rehab program, then go out back out into their neighborhood or whatever, and be at risk for taking drugs again. And one of the things that we think may be happening is that the buildup, the long-term buildup, and the persistence of delta-phosb in the brain could be regulating some of these really long-term effects that explain why addiction is such a process that lasts for so long.
And what is it doing to dynorphin?
It's not 100% clear what it does to dynorphin, but one of the things it looks like it may do to dynorphin is actually feedback and inhibit dynorphin. So it would have kind of the opposite effect. of dynorphin. And that's one of the things that why people are so interested in it, because rather than making animals depressed, it may make animals may have like a drug priming like effect and cause be responsible for drugs being more rewarding rather than what Krebs and the dynorphin seem to be doing, which is making drugs less rewarding.
So if you have delta phosphate and you have Krebs working in opposition, how do you explain sort of that they don't just cancel each other out and you have kind of where you were to begin with?
That's a good question. We'd love to understand that. And what it may be is other accumulated experiences that an animal or a person may have that leave other genes either more ready to be affected by Krebs function or, in fact, blocked by Krebs function. And this has led to something that's very of great interest in the field now called chromatin remodeling. So chromatin remodeling, the general idea behind that is that your genetic information is either ready to be ready to be reactive to what's happening to Krebs, or actually certain genes may be blocked off as a result of other previous experiences.
One last thing I want to ask you about is the role of delta phosphate and Krebs in feeding behavior. So there was a new study in Biological Psychiatry that you wrote a commentary about, where they looked at the role of delta phosphate and Krebs in addictive-like behaviors to a high-fat diet. I guess, first of all, can you become addicted to food, fat?
It's a great question, and I think it's something that there's a lot of controversy about in the field right now. What this paper attempted to do, or what the authors of this paper attempted to do, was show that some of the behavioral effects you would see in an animal after long-term access to a high-fat diet and then abrupt withdrawal of this diet are quite similar to what you would see in an animal if you were to treat them with drugs for a long period of time and then abruptly cease the drug administration. So I think they did a pretty good job in showing that a lot of the behaviors that you see in animals that have had access to a high-fat diet for quite a while and then this stopped suddenly look like drug withdrawal. And I think that was the basis of their paper.
Well, and it's interesting, too. And then they looked at what delta phosphate and Krebs are doing as well. Can you kind of go over some of their findings there?
Sure. They found actually reductions in Krebs function during a high-fat diet withdrawal. And then they found also reductions in delta phosphate. So This is pretty interesting, and some of the findings were a little bit unexpected. If we go back and compare them to what we found with drugs of abuse, suggesting that there may be some slight differences between drugs of abuse and high-fat diet. One of the things that was surprising is that the delta phosphate decreased in the brain very rapidly after withdrawal from the high-fat diet, whereas with drugs of abuse, I think it's been shown that the delta phosphate is sustained for a much longer period of time. So that was something that that suggests that addiction to foods and addiction to drugs may be slightly different. Another thing that would be slightly unexpected, if we look at what happens and compare it to what happens with drug withdrawal, is that Krebs levels actually went down in the nucleus accumbens during high-fat diet withdrawal. Again, we would expect, and we have shown in other studies, that Krebs goes up during withdrawal, and we think that this is one of the things that may contribute to the kind of dysphoria or the nasty feelings you would experience during drug withdrawals, is that increase in Krebs function. So they didn't show any increase in Krebs function. They showed a reduction in Krebs function. I should mention that one of the problems with any studies or comparing across studies is it matters a lot when people are looking at how these molecules are functioning, the time points. And, of course, as you might expect, everybody does it a little bit differently, and it's totally possible that over a 24-hour period you may see kind of cyclic increases and then decreases, and levels may bounce around, and it really does matter when you look. And it's kind of the idea would be when you took the snapshot of what was going on in the brain. So they took their snapshots a little bit differently at a little bit different time point than we ordinarily do. So it's totally possible that if they had looked at a different time, or if we had looked at a different time, the results may line up a little bit better.
So were they able to conclude at all whether or not addictive like behaviors to food or high-fat diets could fall into the same category as addiction to drugs of abuse?
I think they showed that pretty clearly with the behavioral studies, and they showed pretty clearly that withdrawal from a high-fat diet causes a lot of the behavior, a lot of behaviors that are quite similar to withdrawal from drugs. They also showed that some of the same molecules that we would expect to be affected by drugs of abuse were affected by a high-fat diet. I guess the only place where there's kind of a little bit of a dissociation is what those molecules are doing. In some ways, it looks like the molecules are doing slightly different things, but clearly the behaviors look similar.
That was Bill Carlezon from McLean Hospital, talking about the neurobiological pathways involved in addiction. Another line of research in Carlezon's lab is investigating the effects of an hallucinogenic drug called Magic Mint, or Salvinorin, on mood. The drug was originally used by Mexican shamans who sought it out for spiritual journeys. But in recent years, Americans have been buying the relative of the mint off the internet, and several states have passed legislation to control or ban its distribution. In the June issue of The Scientist, I reported on how Carlezon's team has found that the drug activates kappa opioid receptors, and this seems to produce the negative feelings associated with drug use. Carlezon's team has also found that animals appear to behave depressed after they're given the active ingredient in Salvinorin called Salvinorin A. The findings suggest that Salvinorin A holds promise for guiding drug discovery for mood disorders. A few of our readers wrote in to tell us about their experiences using the plant. Our staff writer Bob Grant will be reading excerpts from our readers. First, one reader, called Evan, queried the results of the study in animals based on his own experience with the drug.
I believe that the signs the rats gave were misinterpreted. I don't think that the Salvinorin A put the rats in a depressed state, making them lack the motivation necessary to get the sugar. I think it was more the fact that they were probably in an altered or completely different reality in which sugar was not necessary or didn't exist. I am speaking from personal experience. I have experienced the effects of Salvia divinorum on several occasions, and not once have I become depressed from it. I either feel elated with a mild dose, or a bit scared and confused with a high dose.
Another reader, named Mike, wondered whether the way in which animals received the drug might influence the results.
Potency is very dependent on the method of use. I imagine intravenous use in rats would lead to effects much the same as smoking. In which case, I think the interpretation of how the rats refused to partake of the sugar pellets may have been misinterpreted as far as what it might mean in human subjects, or at least implied in the article. I am not sure if it was the after effects that were measured or not, but would be really interested to find out. I myself have experimented with salvia quite a bit, and I think a test that tells whether or not a rat is hungry while the chemical is actively in its system is absurd, and it should be delayed in order to measure the after effects, which would tell us what lingering and long-term effect it has on the psyche, as opposed to an immediate 5 minutes or half hour.
We'd like to hear from scientists about kappa opioid receptors and mood disorders. Please post your thoughts on thescientist.com. And finally, an opinion in our June issue received some cheers for suggesting that Alzheimer's disease and senile dementia are separate diseases, as perhaps Alois Alzheimer himself had believed. Ming Chen writes, "While successfully arousing support from the public and Congress in hopes of a cure, this definition has singled senile dementia from other senile conditions and misguided its research toward pathogen hunting. This may be why, after 30 years of study and more than 60,000 papers published, the origins of senile dementia remain an enigma." Let us know what you think about whether Chen and Alzheimer were right. Drop us a note at thescientist.com. While you're there, you can read our daily news stories, our Culture Friday series, and the blogs from our editors. That's all for the Scientist Podcast this week. Thanks for tuning in.
This edition of The Week was brought to you by Invitrogen. Gibco cell culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.